2003 Salt Lake Sunstone Symposium presents Session 263, The Book of Mormon, A Symbolic History, A New Perspective on Its Place in History and Religion, a paper presented by C. Jess Grosbeck, with a response by Dan Weatherspoon.
Welcome everybody to Session 263, The Book of Mormon, A Symbolic History, A New Perspective on Its Place in History and Religion. Jess Grosbeck will be the presenter, and Dan Weatherspoon will be the respondent today. Just short bios on both of them. Jess's will be really short. My writing wasn't quick enough to get everything he told me, but he's a psychiatrist and a psychoanalyst, and he has a long-time interest in, and I know I'm going to mispronounce this, that's it, and ancient healing practices. He's currently writing a biography on Joseph Smith, and he is a associate professor of psychiatry at University of Davis, and he currently lives in Mount Vernon, Washington. Dan Weatherspoon was raised in California, in Sacramento, and then later on in San Diego. He served in the Seattle, Washington mission, where he taught senior couple missionaries at the MTC for 2.5 years after he returned home. He's a graduate from BYU with a philosophy, a Bachelor's of Art, which he got in 1987. He then went on to receive a Master's in Religious Studies from Arizona State in 1990, and also has a PhD in Religion from Claremont Graduate University in 1996. He's worked in rare books at a homeless shelter and has taught at Salt Lake Community College for many years. In 2001, he became editor and executive director of Sunstone, and which is his current position. He's married to Lori, and they have two kids, Alex and Hope. Jess Grosbeck.
I'd like to have introduce my wife, Sylvia, and my three sons, John, David, and George. And it's a pleasure to be here with them also. Sylvia, you want to come up and put this down? Actually, giving this talk today, I feel a little bit hesitant. Terry O'Brien's in the audience. You'll probably hear from him later on. And he has written extensively in this field. I feel a little bit like, with him present and others too here, I know Dan's another one. I feel a little bit like the fellow who died and went to heaven. He lived a good life, but immediately he was depressed because he had no talent. In heaven, you had to have a talent. Everybody had a talent. And so he felt bad. Peter came to him and asked him what was the problem. He said, I haven't done anything. I'm nobody. And he said, well, now, wait a minute. Isn't there something you've done in your life that makes you an expert in something? He thought. He said, well, no. He went through his life and he said, well, I was in the San Antonio flood in 45. And Peter said, well, we have no expert on the San Antonio flood in 45. Get your facts together and come on up and be one with us. So he did that, went together, started feeling better, got up ready. All the audience in heaven was there. Peter got up to introduce him. And just as he introduced him, he said, by the way, Noah's in the audience. So I do feel a little that way with Terry, so we'll see what comes out of that. I'd like to begin my paper today, moving some aspects of it and explaining more of it as we go along. The Book of Mormon came forth as a religious history of America and its native peoples, and as such attempts to evaluate it as a symbolic or mythic treatise are highly relevant, which is what I plan to do. Using help from ethnographic studies, Jungian psychology, and the work of historians of religion, such as Mircea Eliade and others, I contend that Joseph Smith operated in much the way as a shaman does in many cultures. Through his spiritual sensibilities, he was able to access at deep subconscious levels all the fragmented traditions, problems, expectations, dreams, and needs of his time and place. European and Native American cultures in clash, and needing assimilation, a spiritual expectations of this promised land, and weave them together in an immensely satisfying way. Yet with Smith's shamanic hits, as it were, they were symbolically, not literally true. Nevertheless, they were then and still are today so psychologically powerful that it's easy to understand why so many strong connections can be made between the Book of Mormon and many ancient, modern geographic and cultural settings, yet are ultimately frustrated when trying to fit these into literal frameworks. And that's kind of a summary of what I want to try to do today in these few short minutes. I'd like to begin by pointing out that there are many, many theories about the Book of Mormon, and I'd just like to highlight those very briefly. First, I'll turn this on here. Yeah, here we go. Right here. Here. First, the first category is that the Book of Mormon, ignore this horizontal symbolic history for now. We're going to come back to that a little bit later. The Book of Mormon is proclaimed by certainly all true Orthodox Mormons as an ancient historical text. Hugh Nibley is perhaps the greatest exponent of that, and I won't spend a lot of time on Hugh Nibley's work. I'm presuming most of you are familiar with that. He, of course, goes to many of the Near Eastern studies, and in much of his voluminous research has tried to point out many parallels to incidents in the Book of Mormon, events in the Book of Mormon, practices, show the correlation, and attempt especially to show that many of these correlations could not have been known in Joseph Smith's day, and thus showing the Book of Mormon has to be an ancient text. Farms, Foundation for Research at BYU, led by many different people, Hugh Nibley, of course, contributes there, have spent a great deal of money and time on ancient Judeo-Christian biblical parallels, kind of amplifying the work of Nibley. Richard Bushman, and John Wells. These are other individuals who've done a lot of research. Chiasmus, a special structure in the way the Book of Mormon is written, is utilized as a proof text that the Book of Mormon is an ancient book, similar to ancient Hebrew documents. Word prints is another statistical study by individuals showing the Book of Mormon, it was written by different people, different individuals, thus attempting to prove that it's an ancient book. And many others have done that. Now let's go to the next one, Sylvia. Then we come to the 19th century models. I've listed a few of these: Dan Vogel, Brent Metcalf, Edward Ashmont, Stan Larson, David Wright, Anthony Hutchinson, and many others. Dan Vogel, for example, has done a prodigious work in reviewing 19th century practices. The anti-universalism, the raging theological issue about universalism and salvation. He points that much of this material is in the Book of Mormon and sees that the Book of Mormon as sustaining that idea, giving credence to the idea that it's basically a 19th century product. The anti-Masonic themes. And also probably, I think, his best work when he goes back and researches the Indian lore of America and what the Americans thought of the Indian, the ambivalent attitude toward the Indian. He was the noble savage versus being a terrible, frightening individual here in this country to overcome. And thus showing by amplification the background that basically the Book of Mormon was essentially a book that was just answering the questions of the day and not necessarily being an ancient text. I think Stan Larson and David Wright have done some of the best research, some of the most challenging research. Stan Larson has taken 3rd Nephi, the text of 3rd Nephi, and shown that if you go back into the biblical text, it's very difficult to show that it is really an ancient text at all. David Wright has done the same with chapter 13 of the Book of Alma. Very difficult to show. His conclusion as an expert in this field shows that it really is not and cannot be an ancient text on that level. And I won't go into, there are many others who have contributed tremendously in this area. Brent Metcalf, for example, has done a marvelous work in terms of tracing with a lot of powerful evidence showing that the Book of Mormon was the product of one person, Joseph Smith. And he does this very interestingly by looking at the translation process beginning with the Book of Mosiah. And so we have these theories. We might also mention B.H. Roberts, who was one of the first back in 1922, when he was given a list of questions by an astute individual asking questions about the Book of Mormon that he could not answer. And he came up with a possible idea that the Book of Mormon could have come out of the creative imagination, the creative mind of Joseph Smith, utilizing the view of the Hebrews by Ethan Smith. It's a view that's unclear exactly what Roberts ended up really believing. He believed the Book of Mormon, I think, to the end of his life, but it certainly opened the door to other theories about how the Book of Mormon came about. Then there are geographical theories. Let's go to the next one. And then, as those of you who were in the previous session, there are geographical theories of the Book of Mormon, external and internal. John Sorensen has written a massive text cataloging the 70-plus theories of where the Book of Mormon took place. South America, Central America, North America. There's even one on the Malay Archipelago, I guess, that we have. And these theories, both external and internal models, are very prominent. Sorensen has done a tremendous work in this area, showing what the Book of Mormon could be. Of course, his theory is that it's most likely in Central America. Let's go to the next couple just to show an example of that. This is just a catalog, and this is how he's taken the narrow neck of land northward, land south of the Comora, etc., and then cataloged the various theories and how they fulfill them or not. Okay, that's fine. Let's go to the next one. This would be a model of the Book of Mormon. If you take the Book of Mormon as a text, you have to satisfy geographically this kind of picture if you're going to have an accurate model. And unfortunately, most of the models fulfill some of these, but not all of them. Okay, that's good. This is an interesting one. For those who may not be familiar with this, this shows... can you turn it around, Sylvia? Let's turn it around that way. There we go. That's right. Yeah, these are the Great Lakes region. This shows... Now, this is one of the theories by Delbert Curtis about how the Book of Mormon fits into the Great Lakes region and how it all took place in North America. Okay, that's fine. I'll show that. So basically, these theories then are all very, very impressive. But now let's go to the 20th century and let's look at some of the other theories that are a little bit different. Coming into the 20th century, these aren't exactly theories in a total sense, but W. Cleon Skousen, under the auspices of President McKay in the 1950s, utilized the Book of Mormon as a powerful instrument against the whole movement of communism, the Book of Mormon being a direct model for countering that terrible evil. I myself, for example, saw The Godfather, a movie that they say changed the American psychology. And it's a movie that where you could utilize the Book of Mormon as a direct model as to why the Godfather, how it could be explained. Nibley recently, in the last few years, has talked about the genocidal wars in the world and talked about the Book of Mormon as a model for the 21st century, a book that is really quite remarkable in that sense. I have also, I'm going to say more about that a little bit later. Now, looking on the other lane here, psychohistory, Robert Anderson, a good friend of mine, and W. Moraine have written as psychoanalysts and psychiatrists on the psychological life of Joseph Smith and have attempted to show that the Book of Mormon, in essence, is basically a product of his inner conflicts and giving kind of a new perspective. Well, what can we say about all these theories? My conclusion about these theories, let's put that on right there. My conclusion about all these theories is that they are They are incomplete and at best indeterminate and very much inconclusive. For example, take the ancient text theories. Most of those theories are parallelograms, as it were, attempting to get parallel information to coincide with what's in the Book of Mormon. The problem with that is that there's so many things left out, and it really isn't a very good proof text method. It may convince some people, but it's really not very convincing scientifically. But what about the 19th century models? Well, in a sense, they suffer from a different kind of problem, I think. They're limited. They're fragmented. They may illustrate certain points about the Indians. For example, Dan Vogel, the remarkable job he's done in showing the background, cultural background of the Indian issue is very impressive, extremely impressive. But again, it doesn't get to the total picture of what is the Book of Mormon about? How do you explain a book that has influenced so many people for so many generations, thousands of people, millions of people? We're here today still talking about it. And it doesn't give an overarching theory. None of these theories, as I maintain, give an overarching theory as to what the Book of Mormon's about. The psychohistory, even what I've written about, I feel has many significant limitations. I think the biggest limitation of Anderson and Moraine's work is that it's based on Freudian theory, which is very limited theory. It doesn't get into the symbolic context, which Jung's work does, and of course, obviously, I'm biased in that direction. So basically, I'm saying here that that it's inconclusive and inconclusive and limited and with changing conclusions. Even the work that we've heard about in terms of DNA, I think I don't know that much about all of that, but again, I think a lot more research needs to be done. But certainly it's challenging in terms of what we need to rethink about the Book of Mormon. So what is the Book of Mormon? Well, let me now go ahead and offer a new theory. I guess it's sort of new. I've talked about this in several years before, but I'm trying to put this now into an overarching theory, a theory that I think has the best chance to explain all the data about the Book of Mormon. Even these many theories we've just gone through will have a place for that. As I noted before, the Book of Mormon came out of the interface between, it came out of the time when there was an interface between the European, white Europeans settling America, dealing with the Indians, and the tremendous assimilation process that demanded. When the Book of Mormon came forth, however, it came forth as a religious history, or as an alleged religious history, and it deserves to be viewed as such. And as a religious history, I want to maintain that it is a symbolic and mythic history, first and foremost. Now, just what am I talking about? Jung stated that a symbol is the best possible explanation of something that is present and that is either on the horizon or in the current reality, but yet unknown. He referred to the various expressions of how symbols may appear. They may appear as an image, such as in a dream or a fantasy, an artistic painting, a concept such as a tale or a story, a feeling state with a nuance-like feeling with godlike qualities, or an emotional experience that the receiver may have that penetrates deep into the heart. Or it may be a behavioral act, such as a ritual act that takes place. I think those are the four general manifestations of how a symbol occurs to a person. Eliada added this. He said that a symbol is a modality of the real or condition in the world which is not evident on the plane of immediate experience. Moreover, a true symbol is always religious or spiritual and reveals a world pattern that is powerful and significant for human beings. He added that its essential characteristic was its multivalence. That means it covers many areas at once. It's not just one area that it explains. And its capacity to express simultaneously several meanings, the unity between which is not evident on the plane of immediate experience. He also noted that symbols have a capacity by which diverse realities or fragments of experience can be fitted together or integrated into a larger system. Lastly, he noted the symbols have the capacity for expressing paradoxical situations or patterns of these ultimate reality experiences that can be expressed in no other way. Joseph Campbell talked about symbols being the core of any myth. and he talked about the functions of myth to give meaning to people's lives, to help them explain the universe, and to help them chart through their own life experience. He quoted Adolf Bashian, who talked about the fact that even though these symbolic mythic experiences are all over the world, in all religions, they all have a different face, a different form in each culture. And yet, he said, behind each of these differences, there are elementary ideas, there are commonalities worldwide, all over the world, that are very, very similar, universal patterns, as it were. Jung called these archetypal patterns and explored this more fully, and I think probably did the best job in that area. And he noted how the living symbol shapes and formulates an unconscious factor in people to help them live their lives. He said this, in every soul it touches an associated chord. Since on the one hand the symbol is the best possible expression of what is still unknown, an expression moreover which cannot be surpassed for the given epoch, it must proceed from the most complex and differentiated contemporary mental atmosphere to the lowest and most primitive. In other words, a symbol has to include the good and the bad, as it were, the black and the white. It can't, and the dirt and the chaos, as well as all the finery and the beauty, you see, if it's a true symbol, to cover everything. Well, so what I want to do then is try to explore a little bit about what some of the famous ethnographers and historians of religion have said about these patterns worldwide. Now, Iliada points out that in a primitive society, and probably in our society, if we were in most modern societies too, in a general sense, we conceive the world very fundamentally as in this way. First, there are borders, and outside the borders is chaos, evil, darkness, the unknown. I mean, for example, what do we think about Iraq, those of us who've never been to Iraq? It's a dangerous place, you know, or the Middle East, or if a place you've never been, you see. The microcosm, in other words, the outer boundaries of where you live. Then he talked about the fact that in most societies we have what's called a center in which you organize your life and your whole experience. He called it the phenomenon and the right of the center. And he talked about the fact that that in these cultures where there's a center. One of the oldest models in virtually all cultures they've studied is the model of the three cosmic regions, heaven, earth, and hell. And the center constitutes the axis where those three areas meet, heaven, earth, and hell. Iliada called this the breakthrough plane. It's a communication between these three zones where life really takes place with the gods. He noted this conception is quite archaic and is one of the oldest conceptions in the history of the world. And he noted also that in the oldest healing system in the world, which includes shamanism, shamans are these medicine men who go into trance, and actually they're the ones who go to the upper, middle, and lower worlds. They connect the three worlds. They are the representatives of a society who are able to do that, to bring peace and harmony to the people whenever there's crisis. Now he says, for example, the manifestation of this center has most universally been represented in a mountain, a tree, or a column situated at the center of the world as a symbol. Iliada noted that this symbol is widely distributed. For example, Mount Tabor in Palestine is often called the navel or the umphalos of the world. Mount Gerizim, also in Palestine, is also called the navel of the earth. Golgotha, for some Christians, is the center of the world. It's where Christ shed his blood. There's even one story amongst the Syrians that Adam was created at this very spot, so that later on the cross of Jesus was erected there, you see. For the Muslims, the highest elevated place on earth is the Kaaba, there in Mecca, because that is where this sacred stone is. It is the most sacred stone where Muhammad was born. And this is that center place. This is what brings together the whole Muslim religion. But probably the best example of the center of the world concept, religious-wise, is that of the Native American healer Black Elk. don't know how many of you have heard of black elk. Have you heard of black elk? Yes. Well, let me just summarize. Black elk at the age of 9, and if you want someone to parallel a vision as impressive as Joseph Smith's, go read Black Elk's age 9 vision he had. It is absolutely one of the most remarkable things I've ever read. Anyway, to make a long story short, he talks about his 6 great-grandfathers and how they come to him. And finally, how he is shown the whole world, basically. And what he comes down to is this. I looked ahead and saw the mountains there with rocks and forts on them. And from the mountains flashed all colors upward to the heavens. Then I was standing on the highest mountain of them all. Round about beneath me was the whole hoop of the world. And while I stood there, I saw more than I can tell. And I understood more than I saw, for I was seeing in a sacred manner the shape of all things in the spirit, and the shape of all shapes, as they must live together as one being. And I saw the sacred hoop of my people was one of many hoops that made one circle, wide as daylight and as starlight. And the center grew one mighty flowering tree to shelter all the children of one mother and one father. And then he goes on later and says, but anywhere is the center of the world. So he talks about how this marvelous center was going to organize the whole world, you see. Again, a perfect example of this archetypal, symbolic, powerful thing that organizes human beings in a deeply religious sense. Now, let me tell you one thing that happens when you are at one of these centers. You get in touch with absolute truth. You know the truth, for the gods have spoken. The upper, the middle, and the lower worlds are in communication. You have absolute truth, and you then are in the only true religion. Now, the interesting thing is, there are more than one centers in the world. That's a subjective experience, but it's not an objective experience, because the same group of people may have various centers where they have that same experience of absolute oneness and absolute truth. And that's what happens to a person. I won't go into the details of it, but for example, a mandala is similar to one of these sacred centers, and how they protect and help an individual get their own myth of meaning as it takes place. Well, now I've gone through a lot very quickly here, but now I want to summarize that and just have you think about what I've just said, the model I've given you, and I want to propose to you that what happened to Joseph Smith at the Hill Cumorah is an exact basic story of the center for Mormonism. And let's see how that works. And this is the model that I think we need. Now let's take a look at Joseph Smith here. Now there are 3 worlds. There's the upper world, this is the middle world, the lower world. How did Joseph Smith start out? He was a young boy doing treasure digging. He went about, they would go out in seances at night. But many times the spirits would move the treasures, and they couldn't find them. They'd find the nails or something, you see. They were always placating the spirits. They had all the magic, all the lore to try to make those changes. In the conscious world, they were all looking for the true church, the true religion, his father. There was a raging battle amongst the Smiths about that. There were questions about the Indian origins. They were looking for Indian treasures. So this was the hodgepodge in which Joseph Smith, the young man, came. Let's go to the next one here. So now what I'm going to propose to you here is that the Book of Mormon represents these 3 worlds here. Here's the world axis. And we're going to show the model here in just a moment here. The upper world of God, angels, and spirits, humans and animals in the middle world, and the lower world of evil demons and evil spirits. And then the axis between. Let's go to the next one. And this is the one I want you to take a good look at here. Let's take a look at the upper one. Now here's the Hill Cumorah. I propose to you that the Hill Cumorah is a model mountain like all these other mountains throughout the religious history of the world. It's a sacred mountain. And what's in the lower world? The spirits of the dead. The spirits of who? The spirits of the Jaredites, the Lamanites. This is kind of a top-level view of the one down below. It's all those dead Lamanites and Nephites and Jaredites there. The Indian spirits of the land, you see. We have also over here the evil spirits, the ones that were managing the plates and the treasures and so forth. Now, along comes Joseph Smith with his seer stone, And by the way, the seer stone also has many of these powerful qualities to access the three worlds. Because I maintain that Joseph Smith operated much like a shamanic leader in some other cultures by accessing these three worlds. So what did he do? Well, through his seer stone, we know that he first saw a salamander. No, Mark Hoffman, yeah, he had a forgery there, but we often overlook that. That throw out Mark Hoffman. The original stories of Joseph Smith said he first saw an animal. A salamander, an amphibian, whatever. The animal changes into a man. Who is it? It is Moroni. And then we have access through that means to the upper worlds. And what was the upper world? Well, that was the whole presentation, the symbolic presentation of the Book of Mormon. The whole dictation of the Book of Mormon becomes that history. This history of this people, you see. And so thus we have the three cosmic zones and how the Hill Cumorah then negotiated those three levels and basically then became the book to begin to answer all these questions. Who were the, as Dan Vogel has said so very well, you know, the Book of Mormon answers, if you want to read a good book, read Dan Vogel's book, The Indian Origins of the Book of Mormon, where he shows how all these questions, which we won't take the time to go into, about the Indians were answered by the Book of Mormon. Who they were. He talks about, it talks about so many other issues too. Okay, let's go to the next one. Oh, excuse me, I gotta hold back. Okay, so basically this is the Book of Mormon as vertical history. This is the Book of Mormon as what I would call the vertical history of America. Now, for those of you who can extrapolate, you can begin to see also that later on, the sacred center of Mormonism shifted. It went into temples. It went into Joseph Smith's upper store, where he gave temple endowments. It went into the Curtin Temple, to the Nauvoo Temple that was to be. We can begin to see shifts in that. But still, the Book of Mormon was really the foundation stone. And, for example, I think that with this model, you can begin to understand why this story has fascinated us Mormons for so many years. You know, most of us know the story of how the Book of Mormon came forth, but very little of what's in the Book of Mormon. I remember years ago when I went on a mission that it was stated that only 20% of the people even read the Book of Mormon, you see. And just now, in the last 20 years, I hear of a lot of people really reading and studying the book. So anyway, so that's it. Now, let me read one other quote. Again, to give you a highlight of things. This is Brigham Young reporting what he heard from Oliver Cowdery. Oliver Cowdery went with the prophet Joseph Smith when he deposited these plates. Joseph did not translate all the plates. There was a portion of them sealed, which you can learn from the Book of Doctrine and Covenants. When Joseph got the plates, the angel instructed him to carry them back to the Hill Cumorah, which he did. Oliver says that when Joseph and Oliver went there, the hill opened and they walked into a cave in which there was a large and spacious room. He says he did not think at the time whether they had the light of the sun or artificial light, but that it was just as light as day. They laid the plates on a table. It was a large table that stood in the room. Under this table, there was a pile of plates as much as 2 feet high. And there were altogether in this room more plates than probably many wagon loads. They were piled up in the corners along the walls. The first time they went there, the sword of Laban hung upon the wall. But when they went again, it had been taken down and laid upon the table across the gold plates. It was unsheathed. And on it was written these words, "This sword will never be sheathed again until the kingdoms of this world become the kingdom of our God and his Christ." You see, there is a mythological story. There is a mythic power behind the whole Book of Mormon epic, the rise of Mormonism, and why its power is able to affect so many people. Not because somebody thinks they can show it's a literal history, or even it's a 19th century model, or it's something coming out of Joseph Smith's mind, or whatever. All those are incidental. To me, I think that this kind of imagery, this symbolic imagery, in other words, the Book of Mormon is a symbolic history of America, of our time, and of our people. Now, let me come back then for a moment and look at the Book of Mormon briefly as a symbolic, as a horizontal history. Now, for example, if going back to the theories we reviewed earlier, the Book of Mormon is an ancient text. If the Book of Mormon makes sense to you as an ancient text, you can turn that into your symbolic life. I mean, that can speak to you in a religious way subjectively, and it can make sense to you that way. Now, apparently there are many people where that makes the most sense, and they cannot consider looking at it any other way. And as far as I'm concerned, this theoretical model allows them to do that. And if those who want to have it be only a 19th century model, so be it. If the Book of Mormon helps you, if the Book of Mormon helps Dan explain Masonry better that way, so be it. That's part of the symbolic history that makes sense to him. Or, for example, if we want to see aspects of the Book of Mormon that make sense as part of Joseph Smith's conflicts, so be it. You can certainly find some interesting parallels. But again, when we look at a symbolic history, it's always more than what we can say about it. It's always more than what we can see in it. As I say, the more we pursue the literalistic historical pathway, the more frustration we have. As Terry O'Brien has said about many of the archaeological theories geographical theories, they just don't include all the elements you need to explain the Book of Mormon on all the levels that it needs to be explained. I think he told me one time that there were 75 different items you had to have to show that the Book of Mormon was truly a historical book grounded in the Americas. Well, most theories have four or five of those, and that's about it. So woefully, they lack what any scientific requirement would bring. Now, let me just end here by showing you an example of an individual who, I want to give you two examples of what happens to people when they become convinced about the Book of Mormon. This is a story from my dear friend Cordell Anderson, who spent his life in Guatemala, going to Book of Mormon lands, going to the Lamanite peoples there in Guatemala, and basically giving his life to serve them and help them grow. He described how he heard a Book of Mormon archaeologist in the 1960s describe various aspects of where the Book of Mormon was. And he was told it was in Guatemala, in southern Mexico. And let me just read one or two lines here. The presenter then went on to designate key areas. This was in northern Guatemala, southern Mexico. The area I was planning on going to live, the Alta Verapaz area, became for this man the land of Ishmael, where Ammon and his brethren performed their miraculous missionary work over 14 years among the Lamanites. By 1967, we were established in said area and acquired a 600-acre plantation in the mountains. Soon we found artifacts everywhere. And he goes on to see how they found mounds and so forth. And as you read his story, it is really quite remarkable, because he then shows how he absolutely came to believe and find the evidence that where he was living was where Ammon was and where the significant sections of the Book of Mormon took place. And to me, there's a good example of symbolic history. It's not literal history, because again, it's only a partial story of how you can connect certain objective facts with the true history. Finally, let me conclude with what I think is the greatest argument and the greatest piece of evidence that I have seen for what I'm proposing as symbolic history. And that is the monumental work of Terry O'Brien, who's sitting here in the audience, who spent 20 years writing this book called Fair Gods and Feathered Serpents. Now, what did Terry do? Let's show this here. Terry researched throughout the Americas the myths of the white-bearded god. And basically, what you see here from stem to stern, from the southern tip of South America to Alaska, stories of the white-bearded god. It is a remarkable research project. And what did he conclude? Well, he couldn't conclude. You know, there are many theories about who was this white-bearded god, where did he come from, and so forth and so on. And again, I would urge you to read his book. And he talks about this culture hero, this white-bearded god, this mysterious visitor. He talks about the fact that certainly somebody like Jesus Christ would be the one who would fulfill those qualifications. And he documents that very well. But the important point that he concludes with is the one I want to emphasize here. He says here, our main task has been to discover the identity and origin of the white-bearded mystery man, or divine culture hero, who left such a consistent mark upon all the Americas long before the time of the conquest. In this, we believe the mission is successful. In an attempt to discover the culture hero origins, we have seen foreign candidates with compelling similarities, at the same time discovering disappointing inconsistencies. And he goes on to talk about the various possibilities about who this may have been. But he concludes with this statement. He says, even though, let me just read it here. If the ensuing foreigner crossed the oceans, whoever he may have been, or appeared from the skies, the American culture hero was already here to meet him. In other words, he concludes his book by saying, if there had been no introduction by the European whites of the Christian religion about Jesus and the and Christianity and so forth, the Judeo-Christian origins, it wouldn't have mattered. He was already here. The most significant, powerful myth going from in all the Americas is the myth of the white-bearded God. A perfect archetypal symbolic pattern that Jesus Christ fits. And so along comes the Book of Mormon as an inspired document and fits that template exactly. And so what does it do? It unites two different cultures. The cultures coming out of Europe and Palestine and the Christianity and the Judeo-Christian backgrounds and the waiting myths here amongst the Indians in the Americas. And it makes it all fit together very, very well. So again, I think that this is, as I say, the best example I have known, I know, that helps me see the Book of Mormon for what I think it is, a symbolic history. Now, in finalizing this, let me just give you my biases. Now, I have a spiritual witness of the Book of Mormon. When I was a missionary sitting in Patzun, Guatemala, in a little old hut, you could hardly see, a 15-watt bulb, I read the Book of Mormon. And I'm telling you, the witness that I had reading Elm in those days never has left me. I know that book's true. But yet, on the other hand, I went to medical school, I studied psychiatry, I went into psychoanalysis, had my head shrunk 15 times. My analyst is now 100 years old, he's still analyzing me. And I have to admit, there's a lot of doubts that I've struggled with on this whole business. But here's what I'm trying to do, and this is my bias. I feel that the natural world and the laws and experiences of the natural world should coincide with the spiritual. And so what I've given you today is what I feel is more of a naturalistic explanation that brings together both the spiritual and the natural aspects of life. And so I guess that's where my bias comes from. Lastly, I would say, and I couldn't find my dream because I pointed it out, I wanted to show you a picture of it too, just like this. About a year and a half ago, and I was not thinking about any of this at all, but I had the most remarkable dream, and I saw the continent of North America way up in the east in Alaska toward Greenland, and I saw this land, and a voice told me the land was unexplored, and I was told that that's where the 10 tribes went. Now, I had an experience that probably many people have had, and what a wonderful thing it is. I'm still going to go up in that land and take a look. Anyway, I'd like to close now, and if there's any questions, we'll go from there, and we'll turn the time over to Dan. Thank you.
Age 22. Pretty much rejected all the gifts that I had been given. I was running from the fact that I knew I was smart. I was running from the responsibilities of having to grow up. I had got to a point in my life where I imagined or did have a conversation with Satan, in which I distinctly heard him say, "Guess what, buddy, I've got you. You couldn't make a good decision if you wanted to. Every time you've got challenged to read the Book of Mormon, did. Met Alma, the son of Alma the younger, sons of Mosiah. saw in them myself. Talented, brilliant, no, hell, that was bad. Talented young men with a lot of gifts who weren't performing. Walked around my room for weeks trying to get to the courage to get on my knees. Finally did. And the Book of Mormon gave me hope that I could be a person of worth, that someday I might be better than I was, that I could embrace my gifts, that I could grow up, that even though it wasn't going to be easy to be a grown up, I could do it. I was moved especially by Mosiah chapter 28, verse 3, which I came to the position where it talked about this Alma and the sons of Mosiah having such a strong love for everyone that they would quake and tremble at the very thought that anybody might not hear the message or know the love of God. This was after their conversion. I was shocked on my mission with about 3 weeks left, having not really thought of that, to have that experience of walking away from a home and not being able to continue, and to quake and to tremble in my soul for days at how important were the things that I was doing, the things I was wanting to share. I hadn't thought about that in a long time, and yet spontaneously that feeling came upon me. Here's where I am now. I don't know if Alma was a real person, if the sons of Mosiah existed, there was a guy named Nephi and Lehi, and what the Book of Mormon is, but it was, and it will always be, a sacred center for me. It is what Jess has described. It is the book that took the highest and the lowest and where I was, and it gave me a center. It gave me what Eliade says. The whole business about a center, I think a lot of people miss what he's getting at with it when the Eliade theories, is that you need to have an orientation in order to have the courage to face life, to feel that the wilderness can be at bay because you have a place to be. Suzanne Langer, a brilliant philosopher, we can live with anything except a lack of meaning, a lack of center. The Black Elk conclusion in Jess's paper is very powerful for me. I saw it. I saw the hoop of all my people. It is, guess what, my mountain was the center of the world. But then at the same time, he says, every mountain is the center of the world. All centers are the center. He introduced his wife. Let me introduce my wife, Lori, on this one. We have a crazy marriage. 17 and a half years of fights and struggle and wrestle. And yet, I think me more than her believes that she's the only woman in the world for me. Because of what she drags me through. She makes me come down from the clouds and deal with the kids. And, you know, she does all these things for me. And so for me to share a totalizing claim that she is the greatest woman in the world, doesn't that make sense to you that I could say that and still have you think that you're married to the greatest person in the world? And you? So what I'm trying to do here is champion the spirit of what Jess has said here in a way that in no way mitigates against its sacredness. Jess surprised me. Not that I didn't know that this was in him, because he threw a lot of things in the paper that were, you know, a lot of things that weren't in the paper, but to close with his testimony after telling you that he doesn't believe that it's a literal history, but it's a symbolic history. And the reason I've wanted to champion Jess, and see, he's teased us for 4 or 5 years at Sunstone with aspects of this shamanic interpretation of the Book of Mormon. And finally last year, he almost got there. So I said, Jess, you're going to get there this year, and you still almost got there, you know, with the full thing. And so I promise you, I'm going to publish something that will pull this all together, and we're going to have a great collaboration, because I think it's a brilliant thesis. I think it's an extremely interesting thing for him to be able to do what he's been able to do and say, guess what? No wonder you guys in the ancient people are excited about it. No wonder you guys in the 19th century were excited about it. No wonder you psychoanalysts and psychobiographies are interesting about it, because these are symbols. He pulled in Eliade. He's pulled in Jung. He's done all these people that I've loved, and it's neat for me to see the Book of Mormon engage with these people. And so I'm here and chose again. I kind of run this show, so I get to respond to whoever I want, and I wish I would have the time to write out my responses rather than do these little dances for you. But I think this is a powerful thesis. It's going to continue to animate my thinking, this idea of why you can never quite pin it down. You think you're almost right there in that ancient world stuff, and you're never going to quite do it, is just... Anyway, I'm just excited to do this there. In my ideal world, this year I was going to do a paper here at Sunstone championing the holographic model of the universe. And the only reason I bring that up right now, because I'm done, I know it took longer than I planned, is I think there is a model of the universe that can affirm shamanism. So the basic idea here that somebody can tap into a rich, full, primordial sea of meaning, good meaning, bad meaning. That's why Joseph Smith can get 95 things right and 95 things wrong about it, the ancient world. Because in this cosmic sort of interconnected web that this holographic model sort of describes, and really I think it's an interesting model. So I think what my plan will be is to work with Jess some more on this. We'll work hard to get it out there and in a form that will, first of all, hopefully at least, diffuse the initial skepticism that says, shamanism? Medicine man? Guys going into trances, coming back with crazy visions of horses and mountains and loops and all this, but kind of say, that's the universe as it's unfolding, at least with some of these theoreticians who are looking at the quantum level. And then we'll do a real good job with Eliade, with Jung, with Campbell. So if you'll let me be your partner, we'll pull something together. So thank you.
I'd like to thank Jess and Dan for their words. I know it's inspired me to think a little more openly about the Book of Mormon and its origins. We do have about 5 minutes for a couple questions. If you can come up here and speak in the microphone so we can get it on tape so that everyone can hear it who is not here today, that would be great.
I thought this was remarkable. Thank you. I'd like you to, if you could, take a specific example in the Book of Mormon and maybe a favorite spot of yours where you think it shows a symbolic truth.
Well, I think Dan gave a great example about Alma. let's just take a, you know, think of this yourself. Any of you felt so low you thought like you wanted to cease to exist, suicidal, go under? Well, just read 36th chapter of Alma. Go through what he went through, that conversion experience. I think that touches, that would be a deep symbolic experience that many people have talked about. I have been there in those, some of those places. You can take many stories. Abraham Gileadi is doing work on the Book of Mormon where he has talked in the same vein. Only he talks about it about the rhetorical model in from Isaiah and other sources. But I think you can take really many of the stories of the Book of Mormon and see their symbolic universal connection. That would be one of the best.
Also, one of the things I like about that is, you know how Neil Chandler sort of said, these are cartoon characters you have in the Book of Mormon. No one's like Nephi. You know, no one's like Lehi. They really, under Jess's model, they are
mythic characters. They are not fully fleshed out people just the way they wouldn't be, but yet, I mean, you know, I was in a model that is a fairly common model. I'm afraid to grow up, you know, and here were some guys that kind of went through that thing, and so they were sort of an archetypal path that I found myself on. So that's one of the strengths to me, is that it kind of handles that weird criticism that these aren't real people. Well, maybe they're not.
To reach the New Jerusalem, you have to leave Old Jerusalem and travel through the wilderness of darkness and despair. And there will be occasions when you'll need to go back to cut the head off of yourself. Gather up some gold and some things you'll need, a few friends, a community, and travel through that wilderness to reach the New Jerusalem. Comments?
That's excellent. There's a marvelous example. That's marvelous. Yeah, there are many ways we could go. Now, let me warn you, though. Let me tell you where I've come. I think one of the greatest problems that we're going to have if you go this route is you're going to have to give up the idea that you literally are the only true religion in the world. You see, when you get this symbolic truth, it's everywhere. You honor everybody's position in that way. It's your truth. It is my absolute truth. But it may not be some other non-Mormon's truth. Now, that may be tough for a lot of people. Anyway, go ahead. Any other comments?
A theory that is going to be complete has to account for all the details. God is in the details. And so the question of this great symbolic kinds of things, and I am quite familiar with Black Elk and his generalities and his symbolism, but you have to account for the details of this very Alma 36 you were just talking about, which is, you mentioned chiasmus. That is a very sharp and a very detailed kind of thing that nobody can pull out of the air or out of their subconscious. So any doctrine or any theory of this sort has to account not only for the great symbolisms that we have in common, but it has to also account for the great details that are there in some of these cultures. And I would like to know how you really can respond to word prints and chiasms and such that are there, the responsibility of everybody, not just Mormons and not just those who take it totally simply. The details are there.
I'd like Terry to respond to that question. He may have a comment on that. And any other comments?
What was the question? How do you account for all the details? Well, I think in all of this you've got to ask, how was Joseph able to absorb his culture? Do we know of another person in history who's been able to absorb his culture at age 21 without any experience, without having written anything before previously, without having turned in term papers and having them corrected 100 times? No great author is able to just come out with his first book and that's it. And so the question is, how did he absorb all this? I think you have to answer that. How could he do this? It's great that he might have done it, but how? And where did he get all these details from that he couldn't have known? Do we belong to a universal consciousness that we all have all knowledge? That's a possibility. We all know everything. It's not a process of learning. It's a process of remembering. And maybe the veil was lifted and Joseph was able to remember things that he knew in the pre-existence that the rest of us have not yet come to and been able to do. No doubt some things were given to him. Dan Vogel says that it's all in our minds. It all comes from our minds. Well, maybe our minds contain everything right now, but we, in coming to Earth, have had a veil put over our minds and we have forgotten much of it. Joseph was able to remember certain details that the rest of us wouldn't know. It's been kind of heavy. I have to tell you one thing. Dr. Grossbeck and I have been friends for a long time, and he's very positive, and in the mission field, he always was making up Book of Mormon lessons, and we had kind of a joke that he had every Book of Mormon lesson we didn't need. And now you've got another one to add to it. Well, we need it, and we're glad to get it. And I have to show you how positive he is. The other day, one of his clients came to him and said, said he'd examined him, and he said, well, what's the prognosis? And Dr. Grossbeck said, well, you only have 60 days to live. And he said, what? 60 days? Doc, I can't pay your bill in 60 days. So Dr. Grossbeck gave him 60 days more.
I enjoyed this paper very much and your response. It's right on target in a large degree with my own research for many years as an archaeologist. And I have to say point blank that I am convinced that the Book of Mormon is literal history, but that it's also what you've been describing to us here today, that it's full of that kind of structure and symbolism. Chiasmus was mentioned as a centering. The whole vision of the Tree of Life, for example, that is Nephi's first vision, is his whole record is structured around that vision. And there's a centering, and the way he records the history and describes it has been mentioned here, going into the wilderness and the journey is modeled on that same thing that you're talking about, and getting to the promised land. And for me, that's a beautiful witness of the reality of the whole experience. And I can't conceive in any way, shape, or form of all of that coming out of the mind of Joseph Smith, even in a brilliant shamanic expression or experience. So I'd only encourage you to think a little deeper about that aspect of it. And by all means, go forward and do what you're doing. But think very carefully about challenging the historicity of the Book of Mormon, as you do. You'll get a big audience, and you'll really limit your audience if you feel like you must challenge the historicity of the Book of Mormon. I don't think we're at that point. Sure, there's questions, a lot of questions that need to be answered, but let's not draw the line too quickly, okay?
Thank you, everybody, for your questions, and this concludes session 263. Thanks for coming.